This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are about 400,000 people in the United States living with Down syndrome. It is the most commonly occurring genetic condition caused by three copies of the 21st chromosome instead of the two that most people carry. In earlier times, parents with children born with Down syndrome were often advised to institutionalize them. The good news is that is no longer the advice, and there's more good news. Great strides are being made in the treatment of the condition and of the person, and life expectancy has also risen dramatically. But that comes with another set of concerns, and we'll get into that as we go through the hour. We're joined by Kathleen LaRiviere, Executive Director of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte. I'm laughing because we were just talking about how to pronounce your name, and of course it went out of my head.
But you
almost
got it right.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Cam Brasington is a board-certified genetic counselor at Levine Children's Hospital and a board member of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And welcome to Melissa Thomason, a physician assistant by training, but also the mother of a 10-month-old son with Down syndrome. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the good news here this morning. It's Monday. We need some good news. The life expectancy factor of this, children born with Down syndrome, the life expectancy for them has increased dramatically in the last few years, from 25 years old in 1983 to around 60 today. How has that happened? Cam?
I think we've gotten smarter about how to take the best care of people with Down syndrome. We know more about health, how to manage health proactively and avoid long-term problems. We correct heart defects early on now, so children live into their adult years, and you know, medically they're healthy, but we're also looking at quality of life and opportunities. And so it's a totally different world for babies born today than it was even 10 or 20 years ago.
What are the medical challenges that children with Down face that other children may not?
About half are born with some type of heart defect that might require surgery. So we make sure that all babies are screened before they leave the hospital after birth so that we know better how to manage the heart conditions. Hypothyroidism is a lifelong concern. We start screening at birth and then yearly for the rest of their life. Other conditions like celiac disease are much more common, so we screen for that. Obstructive sleep apnea, we screen for that. So there are healthcare guidelines that are published that we follow.
And hypothyroidism leads to what?
Hypothyroidism can lead to poor growth, decreased activity, changes in learning and development. And so that's something that we want to screen for regularly and treat as soon as possible.
I said a minute ago that Down is the most common chromosomal condition in humans, caused by three copies of the 21st chromosome instead of the two that most people have. I remember chromosomes vaguely from high school biology. Do we understand how that occurs, this third chromosome, where there should be two?
Most of the time it's just a random event. It's a misdivision of the chromosomes. When that single egg or that single sperm is being formed, it's not typically something that runs in the family. It does happen more often as moms get older. But most babies, when they're born, are a complete surprise to those families.
So it is genetic, but it is not necessarily passed down genetically by the mother or the father or the combination of the two. There's no way to predict a couple might give birth to children who have this.
Right. It's genetic, but not always inherited.
It's completely random.
Right.
The Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte is quick to point out that the correct name of the diagnosis for this is Down, with no S, and then the syndrome is not capitalized. You're very specific about this, and I'm wondering why. Why are you so specific about it? I was correct. I did the promos for this on Friday for this show, and I got all the way through them, and our producer said, it's Down. Not Downs. Okay. When did that happen?
The correct name of the doctor that the syndrome was named after is Langdon Down. His name was not Downs, so the correct name is Down syndrome. There's also the stereotype of Down is a negative thing, so I think we're very careful about, you don't want to say somebody has Downs. It makes it sound like you're saying they're down. So they are individuals with Down syndrome. They're not Downs people.
I'm sure most people listening to us know what we're talking about, but just in case we have people who do not know what we're talking about, this does impact all races, all ethnicities, all socioeconomic. It has nothing to do with any of that. It's a completely random event in nature, and it affects one in every 691 babies born in this country. How does it manifest itself? How do we know that children are Down syndrome children?
Well, at birth, I mean, babies typically have low muscle tone. There's some characteristic physical features that you might see: upslanting eyes, smaller ears, increased folds of skin at the base of the neck. There's no one particular characteristic that says, aha, this baby has Down syndrome, but it's really just the pattern.
And in fact, some babies can be born with some of the physical characteristics, and they do not have Down syndrome. So you can perform tests at
Correct.
Birth?
Correct. So any of the features that you see associated with Down syndrome can be seen in the general population as well. Mm-hmm. But again, it's the pattern that increases your suspicion. So we do a blood test. Draw blood, look at that baby's chromosomes, and look for the presence or the absence of that extra chromosome 21.
Now, I've known a lot of children with, I don't know how it is that I do, but I know a lot of children with Down syndrome, and they have always, to a person, been delightful. They are energetic, they are funny, they have a great sense of humor, the ones that I know at least, and they express great affection for people. They are the sweetest people on the planet.
You haven't seen my son when he's angry.
Well, we all get that way. You should have seen me last week. We all get that way. What are some of the challenges that these children face? Given all the positive things to be said about them, what are some of the challenges that they face?
They face a lot of challenges. First of all, you know, there is that perception that people with Down syndrome are so friendly and loving. I think a lot of it is because they are extremely socially aware. So I like to say that sometimes Cameron, my son, will hug me, and he's not hugging me because he's affectionate. He's hugging me because I'm tense. He knows my mood, and he can tell that I need a hug. So it's not even that he's this incredibly outgoing person. It's that he is incredibly socially aware of what's going on around him.
How do you explain that?
You know, it seems to be a common characteristic of people with Down syndrome. I can tell you in my son's speech is very delayed. He's 8 years old, and right. Even for someone with Down syndrome, his speech is very delayed. And he makes up for that by finding other ways to communicate and being very, very perceptive. That's just the way he is. So I think some of that loving personality that we see is from that, because in general, children with Down syndrome are socially aware, which is a very good strength for teaching them, because they're very good at learning from role models. If they're in an inclusive class at school and they're in there with their typically developing peers, they learn to act like they're typically developing peers.
Hmm. So they're smart. I mean, they really are, which is what my impression was too, because if you have a sense of humor, that shows a certain intelligence to me. Mm-hmm. If you can take a situation or make a funny quip, that's smart. And yet I was surprised to read that they have sometimes severe intellectual challenges.
There's a whole range of abilities that you see, all the way from close to what you'd consider a normal IQ to lower, but most in the mild to moderate range, mm-hmm. With varying degrees of strengths and weaknesses, just like all of us.
Two of you have children with Down syndrome. Tell me about them. I'll start with you because you have the – well, I'll start with Melissa because she's been very quiet over here. She doesn't want to be on this program this morning. Your son is, what, 10 months old?
Yes.
So there's really – you really don't know much about him yet because he's a fairly new child. But tell me about him.
Wells is 10 months old. He is very sweet, very loving. He loves his big sister. He loves to roll around and play. He is developmentally delayed at this point.
In what way?
So Wells is not sitting up yet. Okay. He's not crawling. He's not pulling up. Just like she was saying, there's a wide range of what these children can experience.
And is that because he's not pulling up, he's not crawling yet? Is that because of the low muscle tone that sometimes
for him it is?
Does that change over time? Does that muscle tone develop? It just develops more slowly?
Correct. They will always be, to a degree, low tone, but with therapies and stuff, they learn how to overcome that and get to a place where they can function like regular, typical children.
You're a physician assistant. Had you seen cases of people with Down syndrome prior to your son being diagnosed?
I had seen a few, but I don't think that it's something that is focused on in medical school, and they don't teach a lot about special needs children, about Down syndrome and other developmental disabilities that children can have.
Mm-hmm. And your son, Catherine, is 8 years old.
He is.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about him.
He's a wild little man. My grandmother always says there is nothing wrong with Cameron that has anything to do with Down syndrome. It's because of testosterone. He is all boy. A lot like Wells, Cameron crawled late, he walked late, and he more than made up for it. That boy is freakishly strong. You should see his abs. You know, at 8 years old, he is just all muscle.
Wow.
As I said, his speech is very delayed, even for somebody with Down syndrome. That's a constant challenge. He is in speech therapy at school, speech therapy at home, and, you know, we're confident that he's going to catch up and he's going to get there, but that is his biggest challenge. He is developmentally delayed as cognitively as far as at school. I would say that at 8 years old, he's probably more equivalent to a six-year-old in school. He is in a great, great school where he is in an inclusive classroom with supports. And getting that, he is getting all the exposure to the general curriculum. And, you know, maybe if the class is learning 10 things and Cameron's only retaining six of them, that's still six things that he now knows that everybody else in the class knows as well.
You know, I said in the beginning also that years ago in the 50s and 40s, when children were born with Down, the parents were advised to institutionalize them, and many of them did. Joseph Kennedy did not, and I think that is where a lot of this thrust toward bringing this out into the open began. But now that they're out in the open, they lead lives, and they become adults, and they get jobs, and they interface with the population at large. What is life like for an adult person with this?
Well, I think, the opportunities are different now for children born than the adults that we see today.
Well, I guess my question would be, if a child is, as your son is, slightly behind in his development at 10 months, and your 8-year-old is more like a 6-year-old, at what point do they catch up? I mean, is there a level that they reach that obviously they can function in the world, so they reach a level. So talk to me about what that level might be as an adult.
You know, kind of like Cam had said earlier, it is so different person to person.
Okay.
You know, just like in the typically developing population, you're going to get people that have, you know, strengths and weaknesses. So it is different for everybody, you know. Will Cameron ever function exactly with his chronological age? Most likely not. Mm-hmm. And is Cam going to graduate from high school knowing the six types of volcanoes? Probably not.
It's on Google.
But that's right. But is Cam going to be able to go to the store and buy something and come home and tell his friends about what he did and function day to day? I have every confidence he's going to do that. You know, I want him to have a job, and there's no reason to think he's not going to. Mm-hmm. And I want him to live life to the fullest, the same thing I want for my older daughters as well.
Yeah. Parents worry for their children, and that begins the minute they're born. What was your first thought when your son was born and you found out that he was a Down syndrome baby?
I was devastated because I didn't have the education that I needed to know what the future could be.
Mm-hmm.
My first thoughts when I had Wells was that he would die before me, because everything in my mind told me exactly what society already thought of children with Down syndrome. Once I started to educate myself, I felt a lot better about things, and then I have started to get involved with the Down syndrome community here in Charlotte to help make a difference and to educate other medical providers to be able to help their patients through these processes.
What about you?
I was scared. Exactly like you said, my first thought was, I don't know how to do this. And I remember my husband saying to me, what are you talking about? You're a wonderful mom. We have two daughters at home. And I thought, but I don't know how to be a mom to this baby. You know, the night we brought him home from the hospital, I can remember crying in bed and saying to my husband, he's never going to get married. And my husband said, well, he's going to have to get up in 3 hours. Can we worry about that later?
And the first part of that is not necessarily true. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Celtic Thunder Mythology, haunting solos, rousing ensembles amid imagery of ancient standing stones and a Celtic cross, November the 11th in Belk Theater. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. And Brain Balance, helping children overcome the challenges of ADHD, autism, learning difficulties, and more. Information on the brain-based natural whole child approach is available at brainbalancecenters.com. The Affordable Care Act goes into effect tomorrow, October 1st. That's when the exchange is open to help people navigate their choices in finding health insurance. But those choices vary greatly from state to state in terms of options and costs. We're going to take a look at what it means to people living in North and South Carolina, what you have to do, what the challenges you will face may be, and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show. Health insurance exchanges are scheduled to launch on Tuesday despite technical glitches and political sparring over their funding. The rollout of Obamacare.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, here on listener-funded public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Down syndrome today, the most commonly occurring genetic disorder among humans. Catherine LaRivière is executive director of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte. She's with us along with Cam Brasington, a board-certified general counselor. I think that's right, with Levine Children's
Hospital.
Genetic counselor, and with Levine Children's Hospital, and also a member of the board of the Down Syndrome Association. And Melissa Thomason is a physician assistant and the mom of a son with Down syndrome. Tomorrow's program is about the Affordable Care Act, and in the break when that announcement ran, you made a mention, Catherine, that the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte has been working with people who have children with Down to help them understand the implications of the Affordable Care Act for them. And I had to interrupt you because we had to go back on the air, but I think you were about to say that it's a difficult task because it's so politically polarized. But you say, or I heard you say, that this is going to be good for people with dealing with this situation.
That's what we're hearing. The Down syndrome community nationally recently did a webinar that I was on that talked about the fact that there are so many people with disabilities across the country who don't have health insurance. Mm-hmm. And that although this
topic – can't get it.
And can't get it. And although this topic is very politically charged, they're asking people who have family members with Down syndrome to be open and really look into the details because there is a possibility of getting much better health care for individuals with Down syndrome.
Have you looked into the details as the head of the Down syndrome?
You know, I have not. I did that webinar not too long ago, Okay. And so that's on my to-do list for our next newsletter is to get some more information out to our members.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow. Cam, you have been a pediatric genetic counselor at Carolina's Medical Center for 25 years. How many parents, how many children did you deal with who had been diagnosed with Down syndrome over the years?
Oh, wow. It's been hundreds and hundreds.
And the typical reaction by parents to that diagnosis has been what?
Similar to what Melissa and Catherine said, most people are shocked. You don't expect that the baby that you're carrying is going to have Down syndrome. And I think part of the problem with the medical professionals is maybe the OBGYNs see that in the beginning and they think that that's what life is like for that family. But when I see those families back in 2 or 3 months or 6 months of age, it's a complete turnaround. They are in love with that baby. They have educated themselves about what Down syndrome is. They have hope for the future. And even if they could have changed the diagnosis of Down syndrome, most say they would not.
Is really?
Correct.
Is there anything that you can say to people in those first few weeks or months to allay their fears? Or do they simply have to live through the process and get to know the child and get to understand the condition?
Well, I think a little bit of both. I think that there's ways that we can share that information with families that help them come to that place a little bit sooner. Be knowledgeable about what Down syndrome is, have up-to-date, balanced information, just have resources that are available for families, connect them with the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte. There's really some questions that only another parent can really understand. That connection early is critical.
Melissa, you're a physician assistant, so you work. At this stage of life, at 10 months, is a child with Down any more work than a normal infant would be?
It can be. Wells is involved in physical therapy and speech therapy weekly right now. And there's lots of doctor's appointments that he has to go to because mm-hmm. he has some other medical conditions associated with the Down syndrome. So in that regard, yes, it is a lot busier than what I was with my typical daughter when she was born.
And you use the word typical as opposed to normal. I've already put my foot in my mouth here this morning. Go ahead.
Other than that, back to what Cam was saying, I think that education gives you hope when you get that diagnosis, but right. I think ultimately parents have to go through their own grieving process.
Sure.
And that's something that no one can speed up. It's going to take a different amount of time for each parent, but I think that we can be there, we can support them, we can listen to what their concerns are, and it helps them move through that process.
This comes obviously as a shock to a lot of people because they don't know it's coming until the baby is born, and there it is, and they have to deal with it. The Down Syndrome Association has instituted something called the First Call program based on one that originated, I believe, in Massachusetts. Who's that program targeted at, and what does it provide?
It provides support to expectant families and families that receive find out their diagnosis postnatally. So I think for a very long time, most people did find out postnatally. Like you said, I did, Melissa did. But more and more with the new testing coming out, that people are finding out prenatally. So now they can reach out to us, and we have a program that we have. Like you said, it did come from the Massachusetts Down Syndrome Congress. They came down and trained us and kind of did a train-the-trainer thing. And we have volunteers across our service area that have received a six-hour training course on how to talk to families. And a lot of it's what to say, what not to say, what questions to ask. And it's really designed so that that first contact with that new parent, whether the baby is still in utero or not, really helps them, but gives them the chance to talk. I think it's very important with new parents that although we may have a story to tell them about how wonderful our children are, what's more important is that we find out what they're thinking and what questions they have.
Given the fact that this is such a random event and it's not passed on in families, what role does a genetic counselor have to play in all this, except for explaining to the parent what happened?
Well, that's a good question because I'm always telling people that it takes me 5 minutes to explain the genetics of Down syndrome, mm-hmm. but then the rest of my job is listening, you know, understanding questions that parents are asking, what are their needs, what are the resources that they need, putting them in touch with the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte, answering school questions, where to find resources for school. I mean, it's more than just
you know, it's interesting,
piece.
Mike, is Cam's actually the first person I talked to after my son was born with Down syndrome. When we reached out to the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte, Cam was on the board then as well, and she was the first person I talked to. And I can tell you, really all she did for me was check in with me. Catherine, do you want to talk to somebody yet? No. I can't talk without crying. I'm not ready to meet with somebody. Well, when you're ready, we're here. Mm-hmm. And that was it. She was there. She sent information to me. And every 3 or 4 days, she would just send me an email and say, where are you and what can I do for you?
Melissa, you're nodding in recognition of this.
So I have been involved with the First Call program in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I reached out to a mother who had a prenatal diagnosis, and I thought she wanted to be emailed is how she wanted me to contact her. And I thought long and hard about what I was going to write and what information I would provide to her in that first email. I didn't provide a lot of details. I just, like Cam said, I just opened up my heart and I told her that I was there and that I would listen and that I understood what she was feeling and that when she was ready to talk, to let me know. We have established a relationship since then. We talk at least once a week, if not twice a week now. We get our families together. It's been therapeutic for me, but for her as well.
Because almost anything you want to know about anything is available on the internet, and if you're smart, you can find reputable sources like the Mayo Clinic website as opposed to some crazy website out there somewhere. What kinds of questions are they coming to you with? Because most of their questions can be answered. So I would think they're not asking you questions about facts and figures and what number that chromosome was, although that may be of interest at some point. What kinds of questions do they really want answers to?
They want to know, is my baby going to be okay?
That's a pretty basic question.
Is my baby going to be okay? I know I personally wanted to know, what was Cam going to look like when he was 12? For me, it was very important that I see a teenager or an older person with Down syndrome, because I knew he was this perfect, wonderful, beautiful baby, mm-hmm. and I wasn't worried about him as a baby. But I needed to know that when he was going to be older, he was going to have friends and he was going to do things, and I needed to see that. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important that with families, and they're ready for that at different times. Some people only want to focus on their baby. For me, I needed to see 12 years from now, and then I could focus on on who he was now as an infant. But that is the biggest question.
And I was going to ask you, Melissa, because several of you have talked about being there offering your help when the time is right, and not everybody is ready to talk or ask questions or be helped. But when they are, when they finally say, okay, now I'm ready, what has made them ready, and what do they want to know at that point when they're ready? Or what do they want to say?
They are ready once they get through the grieving process of losing the child that they thought they were going to have. That's the point that they open up. And mainly they ask questions about what's my future going to look like? What's your daily routine like? What doctors should I see in Charlotte? Which ones have the best bedside manner and are going to be able to relate to what my child is going through and what my husband and I are going through when we're having to go to the doctor 3 days a week and wait in waiting rooms? Mm-hmm. Are they going to be understanding of that, understanding of the fact that I can get frustrated easily because I have been in a doctor's office 3 days this week? They're also asking about some of the raw emotions that they may have felt there in the beginning and asking if that was a normal response. You can have, you know, varying degrees of thoughts whenever you find this
anger,
out. And I feel like
resentment.
People, they mm-hmm. a lot. And they want to know if that's normal because they feel guilt over the fact that they felt that about their own child.
Yeah.
Very true. Very true. Because they'll tell me later, I feel bad that I was upset and sad. And I love and adore my child more than anything in the world.
But it's normal.
It's normal.
You need to tell them that. It's okay
Definitely.
That you felt that because that's a normal feeling.
Yeah, a big thing, I think, is just normalizing those feelings and those fears.
Of course, the next step for any child is going to school and education. Let's talk about that. I know that the Down Syndrome Association runs education programs with local school districts in Cleveland, Gaston, and Union counties. This is a big elephant in the room. What about Mecklenburg?
Mecklenburg is on our list for this upcoming school year. The Down Syndrome Association actually covers 12 counties, which is 18 school districts.
Okay.
So our director of education started this year in January, and we created a 3-year rollout plan to get into all 18 school districts. So we targeted Gaston and Union because they are the two largest school districts outside of Mecklenburg to be in the first year, so that by the time we knock on CMS's door, we've got great case studies to show them what we've done in the surrounding counties.
So what's going on at Mecklenburg and the other counties that you have not gotten a foothold in? I mean, just because you're not there doesn't mean they're not doing anything.
Oh, no. So, all of our districts are certainly educating children with Down syndrome. They all have their own individual programs. Mm-hmm. What our program does differently is that we have Down syndrome specialists. We ask the district to assign Down syndrome specialists that our organization trains. We send them to conferences. They get 3 times a year, they get a national speaker who comes in to talk to them about best practices. Mm-hmm. They have a jump drive with hundreds of resources and interventions on it. So, Mike, if you were a teacher and my son was in your class, and every morning he comes in and he crawls under the table, and you keep trying to get him to come out from under the table, and you can't. So you don't have to call the Down Syndrome Association. You don't have to call mom and dad and say, I don't know what to do with your child. You call your district resource, who has all this information to share with you about different interventions on behavioral strategies. Mm-hmm. And so now your own district is able to help you, and we have helped train the district.
How do you decide what grade a child should be? When they're ready for school, first of all, how do you decide when a child is ready and where do you put them? I mean, they do go to public school. Children with Down syndrome go to public schools. So at what age do you enter first grade? Is it child dependent?
Most children with Down syndrome start school with their same age peers.
Okay.
You know, most of them start kindergarten at either 5 or 6, depending on where their birthday falls.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are in pre-K first, which is great because it gives you that extra step to get you ready for kindergarten. And then where they go from there is dependent. You know, some children may be retained in kindergarten. Some children may be retained in first grade. Some may stay with their same age peers.
Does that bother them when they're retained like it would bother a typical child?
You know, there are a lot of typically developing children. I don't think it bothers either.
Okay.
You know,
right.
I guess that really depends on the individual. My son repeated kindergarten, and he was in a segregated school in a segregated classroom for kindergarten. And we decided to do that because of his language choice.
Segregated in what way?
I live in Gaston County, mm-hmm. and he went to Webb Street, which is a school all for children with special needs.
Okay.
So everybody in his class had special needs. And then we repeated kindergarten in our neighborhood school mm-hmm. in a regular inclusive classroom. So we very much wanted to do that for him to have it in his neighborhood school.
Is that the trend, to put children in an inclusive environment?
Yes.
How difficult is that for the child, for the parent, for the teacher, and for the other children in the classroom?
There's so many factors you can't even single out one. Depends on the child, depends on the parents, depends on the teacher, what kind of supports the teacher has at school.
Are the child's peers taught before the child comes to class one of your classmates is a child with Down syndrome, and here's what they're like, and here's how they think? Are they given some preparation?
You know, again, it depends on the age. I think the very young ages, they don't need it. This is just one of their friends. They don't really think about it. Mm-hmm. As parents and as an association, we urge parents to come out and actually talk to the school. You know, for my son's class, every year I've read a book to the class and said, do you want to ask me any questions about Down syndrome? And again, he's only in second grade. So I did it for kindergarten and first grade. But again, different parents do that differently.
Putting them in an inclusive environment, why is that thought to be better than putting them in what you called a segregated environment with children with special needs, where one would presume, although it may not be true, that the teachers there have been given a special training to deal with children who have special needs? Why is it better to put them in an all-inclusive environment?
It's not always better. The research has proven repeatedly that children with Down syndrome who are educated in the general education setting, when they get out of school, they have better language skills, they have better social skills, they're more job ready. However, every child is different. There are some children with Down syndrome that either for behavioral reasons, sensory reasons, or cognitive reasons just aren't going to function well in the general ed classroom. So it really is a personal decision for every IEP team, which is the school and the families working together. So every child is different, but again, the studies have repeatedly shown that children with Down syndrome have the advantage if they go through general education.
This may not be a possible.
It works both ways, too. Okay. So there's advantages that the typically developing children get from having a child with Down syndrome or any other special need diagnosis in their classroom. You know, just learning to interact with somebody who thinks or learns a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. Tolerance.
And every child does.
Mm-hmm. Develop friendships with people that are different from us.
This may not be an impossible question to answer, but because every child is different and every Down's child is different. But what can these children achieve in the best of all possible worlds, going through the educational system? What's the best hope?
Well, I think we see a lot of what we consider the superstars when Catherine and I go to the national conferences. But, you know, we're seeing more and more individuals that graduate high school with a diploma, not a certificate. Mm-hmm. There are more post-secondary educational opportunities that are available. So there are programs on different college campuses where individuals with Down syndrome or other diagnoses go and complete, you know, further their education. More are in competitive employment, not just supportive employment. We're seeing more couples getting married, people driving a car. So things that we didn't think were possible even 10 years ago. You know, we had those pioneers early on that broke out of the institutions and started the inclusive education practice. Now we've got these pioneers that are just showing us what people with Down syndrome really can do.
What are the most common misperceptions? I only have about 45 seconds left in the segment, but what are the most common misconceptions people have about children with Down syndrome?
That they are always happy. Because they're not.
Just like any other child.
Really? Uh-huh.
They get frustrated, they cry, they scream, just like any other child does.
And that the language barriers, people think if the child can't express something, then they don't understand something. And expressive and receptive language are very different.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more to talk about some of the things that may be happening in the future for these children and about these tests that we talked about a second ago, these testing that can take place both prenatally and after the fact for Down syndrome. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and WBTV News 3. Tonight at 11, reporting facts, getting answers, finding solutions. WBTV on your side, also on mobile app and at WBTV.com.
And by call experts answering service and call center, now in Charlotte, handling offices, telephone answering needs, accountability, and customer service. Details at callexperts.com. Health insurance exchanges are scheduled to launch tomorrow despite technical glitches and political sparring over their funding. And Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the rollout of Obamacare at 10 o'clock this morning. We'll take a look at the North and South Carolina aspect of it tomorrow morning at 9. And thanks to your early pledges, we've already eliminated 2 days from the upcoming fall fund drive. If we raise another $55,000 before October 9th, we'll eliminate a third day, please. Thank you for your pledge at WFAE.org. We're coming right back. Stay with us.
As mid-November draws light from the day, what better way to brighten things up than with a live performance of Says You? On Saturday, November 16th and Sunday, November 17th, we're coming to the Pease Auditorium in Charlotte for two shows. Tickets, information, and details are available on our website at saysyou.net. That's S-A-Y-S-Y-O-U. Remember, that's November 16th and 17th, a mid-semester break with Says You.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Down syndrome with Catherine LaRiviere, Executive Director of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte, Melissa Thomason, who's a physician assistant with a 10-month-old son with Down syndrome, and Cam Brasington, board-certified genetic counselor with the Levine Children's Hospital and also a board member of the Down Syndrome Association of Greater Charlotte. Put your headphones on. I meant to tell you this in the break. We'll take a call here from Patty in Charlotte. Patty, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share a real quick story about my cousin who has Down syndrome. John is now in his early 40s, so when he was born, obviously, he came up at a time when perhaps there weren't as many resources available to families now, you know, back then as there are now. But just to let you guys know, he's living with my aunt, but he's got a job, so he goes in and he works like Fridays and Saturdays of the weekends at one of the steakhouses and buses tables or does whatever he needs to do. Been doing that for years. He has his little man cave downstairs in their basement, so he goes down every day, does his exercises. He's involved with music. He's involved with other activities. He keeps track of the Notre Dame football schedule, so he's always sending the schedule out at the first of the football season for the Irish. But he always writes a little note that he includes with the schedule. And when he writes in cursive. Now, cursive, not printing, but he is just to let people know, he's doing remarkably well, and I think it all goes back to the fact that my aunt and my uncle and his siblings invested huge amounts of time with him. They put so much effort in teaching with him and working with him and taking advantages of whatever resources were there at the time, and he's remarkable. He is a remarkable human being. He really is. So just wanted to share that story with you guys.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I'm sure that you've heard these stories in the past.
Yeah, I love hearing that. Thank you so much for calling, Patty. That was awesome. One of the things I get to do in my job is go out to different trade shows with different organizations, and it's amazing how many people will come up to me and say, I have a cousin, a brother, you know, and whatever with Down syndrome. And, you know, again, my son is 8 years old, so while this is my profession, as a parent, I want to hear about every 40-year-old out there that there is.
Is the worry that these young people, when they grow up, how do I phrase this? That they will be taken advantage of because they don't appear necessarily to be as bright as they really are in some cases, or they don't appear to be able to handle themselves as quickly or cleverly as typical people can. And that's not always the truth, but will they? Is that the fear?
Yeah, it's very much so. And unfortunately, it's a reality. People with disabilities are 7 times more likely to be victims of a crime. So it's a very scary thought. And as parents, that's one of those things that even when we're holding our infants that we're worried about.
Sure.
But there are so many supports in place now. As Cam said, it's a different world than it was 50 years ago for our children. And now when they grow up, they're having supportive employment if they need that. And they're living in residential homes where they have supervisors. And I think society as a whole is doing a lot more to protect individuals who are different than they did 50 years ago.
We had a caller who couldn't hold and wants to know this. From a genetic standpoint, are some parents more likely to have a child with Down syndrome, or is it completely random? We already covered this, but I think it's important to cover it again for the people who may be joining us now. So the answer to that question is?
Right. So the only thing that's associated with risk for Down syndrome is maternal age. So as women get older, the chance does increase that we'll have a baby with Down syndrome. But still, the majority of babies are born to those younger moms in their 20s and 30s.
And because you mentioned it could happen, the genetic disorder could be passed along either in the egg or the sperm.
Correct.
The age of the man doesn't make a difference?
Well, we say that just because we don't want to just dump it all on moms and say it's all their fault. It can happen in the sperm, but more often it happens in the egg.
And he wants to know, or the caller wanted to know about tests, which is where we're going to go right now. There are prenatal tests available for mothers to check for a variety of conditions in their unborn infants. you can test for Down syndrome,
correct?
What has been the how long has that been available, and what has been the impact of it?
Oh, for decades, we've had amniocentesis available, where we can look at chromosomes from amniotic fluid cells.
But when you do that, when you just do an amniocentesis, are you specifically looking every time for Down syndrome?
You are.
You're looking for everything that could possibly happen.
You're looking at the whole set of chromosomes, and Down syndrome is just one of those conditions
that
you see.
What has been the impact of our ability to do that?
Well, I mean, it's given couples information to make decisions about pregnancies. There are a lot of people that use that information to be more prepared for the birth of their child with Down syndrome, to educate themselves about Down syndrome prior to delivery. When you think about the delivery process, when that diagnosis is given at birth, you know, and there's that sadness and there's that shock. For families that received a prenatal diagnosis and they've kind of gone through that grieving period, they're celebrating their baby when their baby arrives.
They can hit the ground running.
Right.
Is there a difference between screening and testing?
There is. So the diagnostic testing that's available now are either through amniocentesis or another test called chorionic villus sampling. Those are the only tests that look at the chromosomes. By looking at the chromosomes, you either see the extra 21 or not. Those tests both have a risk with them. Of complications causing miscarriage. Mm-hmm. So there are blood tests that have been developed, taking a sample from the pregnant mother, that are meant to screen for Down syndrome and give a modified risk to that mother. So it's really a way to separate out of all the women that are pregnant, who are the small group out of that entire population that might have the greatest chance of having a baby with Down syndrome, and who you might want to offer the diagnostic testing to.
And how do questions or concerns or advice given after when you're talking to somebody who's had a prenatal screening versus someone who's discovered that they have a child with Down syndrome after the fact, how does it differ?
Well, prenatally, I think it's hard for a lot of families because not only are they told during the pregnancy that their baby has a diagnosis of Down syndrome, but then there's also discussions about, I mean, when you have that information, you have three options: continue the pregnancy, being prepared for the birth of that child, you can create an adoption plan or make a decision about ending the pregnancy.
What do people normally do? It's a tough decision.
It's a very tough decision, and that's why we're so focused on pre-test counseling before any of these tests are done, so that people know what they're getting into before they start down that pathway of maybe ending up somewhere having to make a decision that they really didn't want to.
Because I read that of the 2% of pregnant women who get the amniocentesis and who discover that their unborn child is going to be born with Down, that you say 65 to 70% are terminating the pregnancy, but that these numbers are biased.
Correct.
In what way?
Well, the people that wouldn't consider ending a pregnancy anyway are probably not going to have an amniocentesis. So we have a large population of pregnant women that just don't even do any of the tests because they know they wouldn't make that decision. So those that are having the amnio or having the CVS either are on the fence, don't know what they would do, or really feel that they would end the pregnancy if they found that information.
Are those the ethical questions that you should be concerned about prior
Definitely.
To decide? You should know yourself before you go through with this, unless there's some life-threatening issue that you need to have amniocentesis to discover?
I don't think anybody really knows what they would do in that situation until they're faced with it. We can all hypothesize what we think we would do, but when you're actually in that moment, you may make a decision you totally thought was opposite from what you initially had thought. And again, that's part of the genetic counselor's role, is to talk families through those decisions, all those possibilities, help them make a decision that fits with their values and beliefs.
If you've had a child with Down syndrome, are you likely or unlikely, or is it completely random that you might have another one with Down?
There is a form of Down syndrome that can be inherited, and we can tell that from doing the chromosome studies. But the majority of people that have just the random diagnosis of Down syndrome, it's a less than 1% chance that it would happen again.
Could there be a time when the discovery of Down syndrome prenatally could lead to therapy that could stop it, could reverse it?
We're already looking at things like that. So recently, within the last couple of months, there was a report of a researcher in Boston who was able to effectively shut off the extra chromosome 21 in a laboratory dish. And so there's been a lot of discussion and excitement about that.
If you can do it prenatally, if successfully, and he hasn't done it successfully outside of a Petri dish, but if you could do it prenatally, does that also mean you could do it postnatally? Could you go in and reverse the chromosome damage.
That's what people speculate, that perhaps we could do something like that. You know, we're a lot of the research now is focusing on cognitive research, mm-hmm. improving memory and learning, and those treatments are being looked at for children and adults, but we also would hope to think that if we are able to make a diagnosis of Down syndrome earlier in pregnancy and start those kinds of treatments in utero, what kind of effects would we have?
Where are we in all of that? How far away are we from that?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question.
Okay. And if we can do it...
Looking at those things, but I think they're still several years down the road.
Down syndrome
sure.
is not the only chromosomal disorder. So if we can do it with Down, can it be done... Is it a logical stretch to say that you could do it with something else? Or if they discover how to do it in something else, that could be then transferred over to Down syndrome.
Correct. So there's a lot of collaboration between the Alzheimer's research groups and the Down syndrome research groups, because one of the genes for Alzheimer's is on chromosome 21. And so the hope is that what we discover in our research will hopefully help people with Alzheimer's in general, and things that the Alzheimer's groups are learning will help our population.
Do we understand what it is about chromosome 21 that causes all these problems?
Well, chromosome 21 is one of the smallest chromosomes that we have. There are several hundred genes on it, and it's basically you have three copies of all those genes telling you how to grow and develop. So it's like having too many bosses telling you what to do. So, you know, all of those genes, all those hundreds of genes, it's the effects of the extra information on all those genes that create the effects that we see in Down syndrome.
You wrote, Cam, the National Society of Genetic Counselors position statement on genetic testing. What is their position?
Well, the position statement was regarding the non-invasive prenatal screening tests that have come to market. There are several companies that have developed a screening test that, again, looks at fetal cells that are circulating in the mother's bloodstream and giving risk estimates for the baby having Down syndrome based on those. At this moment, those tests are still considered screening tests. They are not diagnostic. One of our concerns is that these are aggressively marketed, and a lot of the promotional materials say they're virtually diagnostic, but they are not. So they are much improved screening tests, mm-hmm. more improved over what we currently have available now, but they still require the same pre-test and post-test counseling, and they still require confirmation by an amniocentesis.
Sabrina, one of our listeners, couldn't hold on the phone, but she wants to know yet if the Affordable Care Act will pay for Down syndrome screening because her current insurance will not pay for it. Do we know the answer to that question?
I don't know the answer to that.
Where would you get the answer to that? Would it by going to healthcare.gov?
Most likely,
listening to this program tomorrow?
Yes.
Why don't we know these things yet? Particularly people, I don't mean to throw you under the bus here, but why don't you know the answer to that question, given the fact that this is going to affect every person in the almost every person in the country very quickly?
Yeah, really, I have not looked into it yet. As I said, I was recently on that webinar about the changes for that, and so it's next on my list to research it. So check back with me in about a week, and I should have my article ready for the newsletter, and we'll have answers to questions like that.
For those people who have this prenatal diagnosis for Down syndrome, I would think they have a lot of questions going on and a lot of serious, heavy, life-changing decisions to make. We have two people here who have children with Down. What would you have done if you'd known prior to birth? And is your mind different? Now that you've had lived with these children, would it be different today?
I don't know what I would have done had I known prenatally. And I'm honestly happy that I didn't have to make that decision, mm-hmm. because the person that Wells is today is someone that I wouldn't give up for anything. So while I think it's great that some people have the opportunity to make that decision, I am really thankful 10 months down the road that I wasn't given that opportunity and that I received one of the biggest blessings that I've ever received by not knowing.
Wow.
I had my blood work came back that I had a 1 in 57 chance that Cam had Down syndrome, and we chose not to have an amnio. We had a level 2 ultrasound done, which is 75% accurate, and it came back that he did not have Down syndrome. I'm the type of person that if it had come back that he did have Down syndrome, or most likely did, I would have spent my pregnancy worrying, and that would not have been good for me or for the baby. So for me, it was I told myself, okay, he most likely doesn't. I'll worry about it after he's born. Mm-hmm.
And this is a need that our first call program is trying to address.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Put your headphones back on. We'll very quickly, because we're very short on time, take a call from Stacy in Charlotte. Stacy, welcome.
Hi. I first just want to give a shout out to the association. They're doing a great job on the radio. I just wanted to comment when you were talking about adoption being a plan. We did adopt our daughter, Gigi, who has Down syndrome, and the Down syndrome out of Cincinnati. The association has a waiting list of parents who would like to adopt. So that is definitely a possibility.
Okay.
Can I share one more thing?
Very quickly.
I just want to give parents hope. My daughter is 80% included in the regular class. And we just received a fabulous email from a typical child in her class. She said Gigi is her role model, that she's had such a great influence on her life. So our kids do have so much to offer to the typical kids in their classrooms. I just want to give parents hope for the future.
Great. Thank you, Stacy. I appreciate your call. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr has been a major proponent of the ABLE Act, the Achieving a Better Life Experience Act, which would, among other things, amend the tax code to allow 529 education savings account programs go to the long-term expenses of a child with Down. Where does that stand at the moment? Very quickly.
It is not finalized yet, but we were very fortunate to meet with Senator Burr about that.
And there are several events that we don't have time to go into now that the Down Syndrome Association has coming up: a buddy walk, a 321 dash for Down Syndrome, plus on October 25th and 26th, a symposium on maximizing communication skills. And you also operate camps for children with Down Syndrome. The best way to find out all that information is?
Go to our website. It's www.dsa-gc.org.
Thanks, Catherine. Thank you all.